Let's just take the time to read part six. So these are the commitments. It says, always train in the three general points. Do not allow your mind training to cause inappropriate behavior. In other words, don't be go to extreme, you know, like sometimes when people meet the Dharma, they think, oh, I'm going to be like, I mean, I did this. Don't do this. You know, you just abandon your family and your friends and you go off into the mountains and you think, you know, oh, I'm going to be a, you know, great thing, Buddha or something, and you start changing the way you behave and you start acting differently. And, well, I didn't do all that, but I take that back. Anyway, you know, don't be reckless, and also don't... If sometimes, you know, you might kill some ants and you think, oh, that's okay, they're just ants, something like that, you know. I mean, we have to be, we don't want to be too serious, but we have to be serious, you know. And I have a friend named Julia Hengst, and she's a psychologist, and she says she's discovered a new disease, mental disease. It's called SBS. It's Serious Buddhist Syndrome. So we need to be serious, but not so much that you change your behavior and you just become one of these, oh, I can't do anything because now I'm a Dharma student, and, you know, kind of people who deprive themselves of fun because they're a Buddhist, or, you know. And even, you know, Lama Yeshe used to say to, even to his monks and nuns, to the Italians and the French, I don't know if it applied to Switzerland, but, you know, when you go home for Christmas and everyone's sitting around having a glass of wine, you should have a glass of wine too. Mm-hmm. You don't want to make it look like you're just so weird that it makes them feel uncomfortable that you've changed so much, you know? And even then, and maybe you don't need to wear your robes when you go back, you know? I mean, I think it's changed now, but it's more acceptable. But 40 years ago, it was pretty weird, you know? So you have to be careful about how you practice mind training. We don't have to be extreme. Or just decide we're going to be beggars and live on the street or something, you know? Take care of yourself. So do not allow your mind training to contradict your vows. Well, that means don't break your vows in order to practice mind training. But basically, when I was reading this book, it said don't become arrogant and think, oh, no, mind training, I'm this great, you know, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it happens. Do not practice the mind training with partiality. That means, you know, we don't practice mind training with our family, but not to the beggar on the street. We have to do it. We have to have equal mind training for all sentient beings, including insects and animals. You know, we don't want to cause them harm and suffering either. So then, the next one is remain natural while changing your aspiration. Well, that's similar to the other one, you know. You don't have to change on the outside, you know. I mean, it's one thing if you want to get ordained, that's okay, you know, because that's a lifestyle, that's a whole lifestyle change, you know. You've decided, I'm going to practice my pratimoksha vows with ordination. But other than that, you know, you don't need to start wearing Tibetan clothes and malas all over you and, you know, whatever, you know. I mean, if you want to, that's fine, but don't, anyway, you know what it's talking about. Just remain, stay you are. You don't have to quit your job and go to the Himalayas, you know, unless you really want to. So that one's pretty easy. Do not speak about degenerated limbs. That means don't talk about people behind their backs, you know. It's a hard one, particularly if you're having trouble with somebody and you need to talk to about it, somebody. And maybe that's okay in a certain context, but just make sure that that's what you're doing. You make it clear, you know, I'm having trouble, I need to talk through something before I go to talk to the person. But really try to direct. You know, I try to think to myself, you know, I'm not going to say anything about somebody I wouldn't say to their face, you know, and better to say it to their face, you know. So we know that one too. Sometimes there's a good reason to talk about, you know. I think there's a little bit of a trouble sometimes in Dharma centers where we take this to the extreme, and there might be somebody who's really causing trouble and disrupting the whole group, but we think, oh, we're not supposed to say anything bad about anybody, so we can't sit down and have a talk about it. And and have to what to do about this particular person. It's always difficult in a Dharma center to know how to handle that. But to just pretend like it's not happening isn't helpful either, because it disturbs lots of other people. So it's not a hard and fast rule that you should never see wrong behavior in somebody else, you know. It's just that we need to be kind about it and also check up and make sure it's just not you. You know, sometimes we see things in other people we don't like, but really it's just something to do with us. It has nothing to do with them at all. So before we open our mouths about anybody else, wait a while, you know, and see if there's a reason. There may not be any reason at all other than you want to makes you feel better to say something bad about somebody, you know. So we have to be really careful about that, because we're so easily opening our mouths, you know. Never think about others' faults. And that's got to be a little bit tempered too, you know. I mean, if we have to have discriminating awareness, you know. If someone's killing people, we have to think about that. So it's not talking about that. It's talking about when you're just kind of in your mind thinking bad things about people, you know. You understand the difference, right? We need to have discriminating awareness about immoral behavior, you know, and as best as we can, stop immoral behavior if we can, you know. But the way this applies to me in my life is I know that if there's somebody I'm having trouble with, and I will ruminate about what they're doing, you know, they do this and they do that, and I find, or their faults, I find that if I do that, when the opportunity arises for me to open my mouth and talk about that person, uncontrollably it comes out because I've been thinking about it. It's almost like I've been doing an analytical meditation on this person's faults. And so then, you know, so then it's just really easy. And so what I've discovered is it's you know, okay, I can register this as a problem, but I'm not going to think about it anymore, you know, just because when we get obsessive about somebody else's what they're doing, you know, and it happens, that it actually ends up not being such a good thing. So, because, you know, we could think we can control our voice, our speech, but if we don't control our mind, then it comes right out through the speech. So that's what that one's about. Oh, in the commentary it says, we can think a lot about our faults. Because we have to think about them in order to heal them, isn't it? But without thinking that we're bad people, that's really a mistake, you know? We just have, they're called adventitious defilements, which means they're adventitious is something that's not really us. So all of our delusions, they're not really who we are inside. They're just things on the outside. So we don't have to identify with them. Yeah. Purify your greatest delusion first. We have to recognize our delusions, other people's delusions, not ignore them. But we need to be skillful about how we relate to them. You know? Like, we don't want to stop the greed that's causing global warming. We don't want to stop our own whatever, you know. We don't want to ignore it. But we don't want to harm somebody by criticizing them unnecessarily. Right? Yeah. Is that kind of what we're... Yeah. But sometimes, you know, constructive criticism is a really good thing. But we have to make sure that the person we feel like we want to hear our constructive criticism is ready to hear it. We can't just go around saying, oh, I really need to talk to you, you know, I don't like your blah, 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 you know. That's why learning nonviolent communication is so helpful, because it teaches us how to sit down and talk about problems without being judgmental and critical. You know, turn it around so that it makes me feel this way when I experience this behavior from you, you know. And don't say that it's wrong behavior. Just describe what they do, you know. Don't put a label on it. Don't put a judgment on it. Just say what it is, you know. You know, a really simple example is, you always leave the refrigerator door open, you know. When I come in, I find the refrigerator door open, you know. And you don't just come in and say, why do you always leave the refrigerator door open? You know, you can sit down another time and find a way to talk about it and say, you know, I found the refrigerator door open, and every time the refrigerator door open is left open, the electric bill goes up. And it makes me feel uncomfortable because I have to share that electric bill with you. So maybe we could think about remembering to shut the refrigerator door. You know, that's just a really simple example, but it's that kind of thing rather than just getting upset and saying, why do you always leave the refrigerator door open? You know, like that. Yeah, we have to be skillful so that people can hear us. You know, particularly in relationships, families, it's really critical, you know. Yeah. But it's also critical not to ignore, because if we ignore, then resentments build up, and then it's really, really bad, you know. So we need to find ways of communicating with the people that we love, how we can have harmony, you know. Yeah. And, you know, the more we practice this, the easier it gets, because the less people bother us. Yeah. Okay. Purify grace delusion first, then abandon hope for results. And there's a few things about this. We can think we abandon hope for results for ourselves alone or for worldly achievements, but we do have to hope for results in our practice. You know, we do want to have results. It's like the Dalai Lama says, there's good attachment. You know, we do want to be attached to our Dharma practice. I mean, not to the point where if someone criticizes us, we get angry at them. But, you know, some desires are good. You know, like the desire to have results, desire to get enlightened is a good desire. But the only flip side of that is don't expect too much too soon. You know, I know in my life, you know, after doing all these retreats, I'm like, God, I thought something would happen, you know. I mean, something does happen, but when you first hear about these things, you think, you know, really lots of things are going to change. But actually, you know, Lama Yeshe used the word organic. Our change is very organic. It's not going to be some magical bullet that comes along and suddenly you're a nice person. Because, you know, our minds are just as organic as our bodies are. And so even though it feels like there's nothing there, you know, there's no physical substance, I think still it heals and grows at a pace like our body does. And when I was in retreat the first time, long retreat the first time, I cut my finger really bad. And I actually had to leave and go get some stitches. I had to go to the hospital. And as I came back and I watched it heal, you know, it took like a few months to heal. And I suddenly understood what Lama Yeshe meant by organic. You know, that step by step, slowly, slowly, our minds change. Just like watching a tree grow. You know, you can't, like, put a lot of water on a tree and make it grow faster. So it doesn't mean you can say, you know, 500,000 Om Mani Padme Hum and shut yourself in the room and suddenly you're going to be a nice person in 2 months. The brains just don't change that fast, you know. But I would like to just put a little plug in here. A lot of times when we have what we say in English, inveterate tendencies, like things we just can't seem to stop doing, quite often there's some kind of trauma there. There's a reason why, you know, we've been traumatized for something, and so you've heard this language, and so we get triggered when some impulse comes in, and there's just absolutely nothing we can do because that our response. Our frontal lobes, where we have reasoning and compassion, gets completely shortchanged. We go right back to the reptile brain, and we respond with our fight or flight response. And that, if that's happening, then it's very difficult for Dharma to touch that, you know. And so I don't know. There are different trauma techniques. Like one of Lama Yeshe's students, her name is Laurel Parnell. She was one of the main people in the U.S. that developed EMDR. Have you heard of EMDR? It's like eye movement, direct, I don't know what it is exactly. But I've tried it, and for things that I found, I just couldn't shift. And so a friend of mine who's an acupuncturist and a Dharma practitioner, she said, well, why don't you just go see my friend Elaine and just try it, you know? I couldn't believe how helpful it was, you know? This thing that was always grabbing me, never did it again. Just because I went and had the childhood trauma healed. So I just want to mention that, you know, if you're having something that just doesn't seem to go away, or, you know, it's just bothered you forever, and I'm sure there's people in Switzerland that do it, or Germany, or somewhere, but there's probably other techniques. So I don't think that we have to think that everything can come from Buddhism, because I don't think in Shakyamuni Buddha's time we had such traumatic lifestyles as we do now, you know? Especially, I think, when we live in war-torn countries where, you know, there might not have been a war in our lifetime, but there's a war in our parents' lifetime. And so our parents carry these imprints, and then we pick them up too. So sometimes it's real helpful to look into Western psychology methods to help with, you know, when you've been sitting a while and you just notice that, you know, every time this happens, I do this. You know, that but ring a bell with you? Is that something that, yeah. So, do not follow delusions. Oh, wait, where were we? Don't abandon hope for results. So this kind of stuff will help you with results. But, yeah. Then, do not follow delusions. So, we can be gentle with others' delusions, but not with our own. Yeah.
What's with the one before?
There's one, give up poisonous food.
Oh, I skipped one? Abandon poisonous food. Oh, okay. It's just a metaphor, actually, for delusions, you know? They're saying that if you read the commentary, it says, you know, if you were to eat poisonous food, you'd want to get it out of you as fast as possible. So things like the worldly dharmas are poisonous activities, so you want to abandon them as fast as you can. That's what that means. So that we want to, and one of the things that this is actually talking about is mixed actions. And this is a really tricky thing. Because I remember Ajahn Rinpoche talking about when we mix Dharma activities with worldly concern, that's a poisonous virtue. And I think that's what this is talking about. That's really hard. Because when we want to be virtuous, we also like to get patted on the back. You know, we like to feel, you know, as soon as we start getting our kind of self-cherishing mind involved in our Dharma activity, then it becomes poisonous. And just because of karma, if the motivation is mixed, the result will be mixed. So if your motivation is to, you know, become famous by being a teacher or whatever, you know, it's not gonna help you get enlightened. Or what was another example of a mixed motivation? I'm going to go down and feed the poor so people will see me that I'm a good person and I'm feeding the poor people and I get my name in the newspaper, you know, because I was down there feeding poor people, you know, or something, you know, something like that. But I'm sure there's much more subtle reasons, you know. You have to check. It's really sneaky. Self-cherishing will sneak in to any time we have, you know, because ego's always looking for its just desserts, you know. Thanks. Okay, so we did do not follow delusions. Do not retaliate to verbal abuse. That's pretty clear, right? Someone yells at you, you don't yell back. Do not wait in ambush. That's a little bit like I was talking about before, about when you don't like somebody or you don't like somebody's behavior and you're just waiting for the opportunity to tell somebody about it, or tell them about it, or reveal their faults to somebody else. That's really bad. I mean, that's so gross, I think you can know when you're doing that one, you know. Don't wait in ambush. It's like, don't wait to ambush somebody and tell them that, you know, they're screwing up. I mean, you see children doing that sometimes, you know, siblings, you know, waiting to tell mom when the sister, you know, stole a cookie from the cookie jar or something, you know. But it happens in bigger contexts, you know. I mean, politicians do it to themselves all the time. They're just waiting for one politician to screw up so they can go on and on and on about how bad they are, you know. So, do not offend others. And this one is something that is another one that we do unconsciously sometimes with the people we love, which is when we've allowed resentments to build up because we haven't found a way to talk to the people we live with and the people we love, that an opportunity arises and we can just let this sharp, stabbing sentence go out that goes right into their heart and hurts them. You know that one?
Mm-hmm.
My dad was really good at that, you know. And I think that we do it, I mean, he didn't do it a lot, but he could do it. And I think that it's just, it could be part of human nature because everybody does it, you know. You just, it's just like the door opens, there's the opportunity, it's like waiting and ambushing, and the door opens and there's your opportunity to say the thing that's going to hurt that person the most, you know. So it's interesting they put it in here, you know. It's like, watch out for that one, you know. Because you see that happen with children sometimes and they're just so crushed. Yeah, it's really sad. That's do not offend others. And it's interesting because in another translation it's called never strike the heart. Yeah. do not offend others. Do not transfer your own faults or burdens onto others. And traditionally it says do not put the load of an ox on a zoe. Because a zoe can handle more weight. This is for the Tibetans, you know. They were nomads traveling, and the zoes could carry more than an ox. I think the oxes were used more to pull. No, they didn't have carts. I don't know. Anyway, so what that means is that, you know, it's pretty obvious. You know, if you're working in a Dharma center, you don't want to give somebody more jobs than they can handle. Because some people are willing to take on those jobs, you know. But what the teaching says is that will come back to haunt you if you do that, you know. And sometimes that happens in families, unfortunately, you know, where the older brothers and sisters end up having to work really, you know, doing a lot of the work because the mother's working or something, you know. And then that ends up causing some friction, you know, unless the children really understand the need, why that has to happen. But if a parent just says, you got to do this because I'm telling you to, you know, I mean, it really can harm a child. But if there's some reason when a child has to do a certain amount of work, then I think it's important to explain to children, you know, they understand, they're not stupid, you know. And yeah, so that's what that one's about. Do not misuse the Dharma. Now, you know, that could be very broad, you know, like don't use the Dharma for your own gain, you know. But it actually, when I was reading this book, it says don't take credit for other people's work. So, you know, say you're bringing the Dalai Lama to Switzerland and takes, you know, 8 people work really hard, and suddenly at the end, one person walks up and goes, "I did it." You know, it can happen too. You know, it's interesting how many people in the Dharma are so blinded to their own egotistical needs. You know, there's some people who are incredible Dharma practitioners, and I mean, we all have that, but we all have a blind spot. And if we have good friends, they'll tell us where our blind spot is, because a lot of times we don't realize that we're misusing the Dharma, that there's something going on here that we just don't see. And maybe we are taking all the credit for something that we did, or maybe we are giving somebody more work to do than they have, and we just don't see it. So I think it's really important in Dharma communities to have enough friendship and enough trust amongst each other that we can be friends and say, hey, you know, and offer constructive criticism, you know, because I really would appreciate if people tell me, you know, I mean, because how are we supposed to know when we can't see our blind areas? Because we all have ignorance. You know, as much as we can be as sincere as anything and try to practice as much as anything, but still, there's some hole in our view, you know. So we need our friends to help us. Yeah. So, do not aim at being the first to get the best. Well, that's pretty clear, isn't it? You know, me first, me first, me first. I mean, that's okay for a three-year-old, but not when you're an adult. And then, do not turn a god into a demon. That means don't let your Dharma practice turn you into a proud, arrogant, self-centered person. You know, don't practice what Chogyam Trungpa calls spiritual materialism, where we do all the practice, we have all the malas, we have all the tankas, we have all the books, we go to all the teachings, we wear all the cool clothes. Mind doesn't change at all. You know? And, you know, usually people are like that because they're suffering inside. And if only, that's why I think it's so important for Dharma practitioners to start with loving themselves and creating an inner acceptance. Because the only reason anybody's like that is because they don't feel happy about who they are. And so they're trying to cover it all up with Dharma. So rather than reject somebody like that, I mean, if we could try to just like give them as much loving kindness as possible and help steer them to the teachings that are going to help them feel better about themselves, you know, if possible, then that would be very helpful, because it's really sad when, I mean, we all have this to a certain extent, but some people have it more than others, you know. So we really need to help each other to discern what's pure practice and what's clouded with delusion, egotistical needs, worldly dharmas, you know, because nobody's exempt from that until we get to the level of greatness, you know. That's why we have Sangha. And then the last one is probably the most universal of all religious rules, is do not seek happiness by causing unhappiness to others. That's just the golden rule, you know, that we... do you have the golden rule?
Yes.
Yeah, you know. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you, you know. Don't... It's really, you know, that happens a lot in relationships, you know, and when you've been in a with people have been in relationships for a long time, and the relationship's gone stale because they don't talk about how much they resent each other, and some new person comes along, and, oh, I think I'll go to this new relationship. Really makes somebody unhappy, the person that gets left behind. So what do you do there? You know? Well, just think about it before you get involved, I suppose, with somebody else. Because I think the thing that we really need to understand is karma. You know, I'm trying to make myself happy at somebody else's expense. That means I'm not going to really be able to be happy. It'll be temporary, but at some point it'll end up, I'll be unhappy again. And then we'll have three unhappy people instead of just two who need to go to marriage counseling, you know, something like that. I don't know. I mean, I'm just kind of talking off the top of my head. But there's lots of ways that can happen, you know. I mean, stealing somebody's things, you know, or I mean, that's what's caused the whole global warming and wars and everything, is this one thing, you know. It's like the people who, like, especially in the United States, you know, the 1% people who own all the wealth, they still want more and more wealth. Their happiness is making the whole world suffer. And they don't see that. All they're concerned about is, oh, I've only got 7 yachts and 8 houses in the Riviera, and I think I need 2 more, you know, so I can invite more friends for the summer. I mean, they really think like that. And then they just look at the people in North Africa who are starving and, you know, trying to get over it, and they just go, oh, those poor people, why doesn't somebody help them? You know, I mean, people really have minds like that. And to me, those people are the ones that need the most compassion. You know? The unfortunate rich people. We can't hate them, you know. We really need to pray for them, you know, because that's what's causing the destruction of our human habitat. You know? And I heard a new thing just recently about, I can't remember what it's called, but trying not to buy new things, you know? It's one thing, you know, to try to drive your car less and, you know, but, I mean, because of my poverty, I love thrift stores, you know. It's much more fun to go shopping when there's only going to be one thing in the store that you can find, you know, rather than having a store full of all these things you have no idea, you know. And it's like treasure hunting, you know. Do you have secondhand shops?
No.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I love secondhand shops, you know. And even, I mean, appliances, things like that, you know. But we can fix things, you know. You can fix an old car instead of getting a new car. It's much better for the environment, you know. So, I mean, we really need to think about how we live the world, because this whole point about not causing people unhappy. I about 10 years ago, I decided that we need new bodhisattva vows. That the bodhisattva vows don't incorporate enough environmental rules, you know. Things like that. Like, don't needlessly buy new things. You know, recycle all your plastic, you know. I mean, those could be part of our bodhisattva vows, because a lot of people get involved in Buddhism and they don't. I mean, now it's so, you know, in your face. But 20 years ago, it wasn't so much, you know, the environmental catastrophe. I mean, it was in my face, but a lot of people. I'm shocked how many people interested in Buddhism weren't aware of the environmental crisis, you know. A lot of people, you know. So, anyway, that's just me going off. Let's keep going. Okay, so then we have the last bit. So the precepts of training the mind. So let's read it together. Okay, do all yogas by one. It's sort of like the same one of put all the blame into one. It's the same one. All your yogas are to abandon your egotistic mind and cherish others more. That's the main yoga, is cherish others. You'll find happiness if you cherish others. And also remembering that things aren't truly existent. So again, it's just studying, meditating, contemplating the two wings of to enlightenment, compassion and wisdom. Perform every suppression of interference by one. That's the same thing. So when we're having obstacles, try to use the thought training to overcome our obstacles. You know, find a way to use dharma other than aggression to solve our problems. You know, there are two activities, one at the beginning and one at the end. And we can't overestimate the power of motivation and dedication. Because we've talked a lot the last day about karma. And so if we are intent on attaining enlightenment, the most important thing we can do is motivate our activities with the mind that wishes to help others, that wishes to become enlightened for all sentient beings, and the mind that remembers that how things appear is not how they are. That in actual fact, things are dependent arisings that exist merely based on my label and the base, based upon their parts, based upon causes and conditions. So dharma is actually pretty simple. It's just there are all these different ways of getting to understand these two things. You know, that everything I experience, I created the cause for. There's no reason to blame anybody else for anything that happens to me, and it's all empty, you know. There's an appearance, like Lama Zopa says all the time, there's appearance, but what to label it? One time I met Rinpoche, he's getting out of the car, and I said, Rinpoche, how are you? And he goes, there's a basis, what to label it? Ha ha ha, you all cracked up, you know? So just remember, there's a basis, the label, it's completely up to me, you know? everything I experience is filtered through my past, through my projection. You know? What someone thinks is the most wonderful person in the world, I can't see it at all. So, what is that person? That person, and that person himself feels something completely different. In the end, it's all because it's dependent on our past conditioning, how we perceive our world and how we perceive ourselves. And because it's a dependent arising, it's flexible, it's changeable, we can change. We can change from finding someone we find disgusting to someone that we love through the power of mental thought training. You know, it's not impossible. So, one at the beginning, one at the end. Motivate to be sane and light before all sentient beings. At the end of the day, even if you can just do it in the morning and the evening, you know, put a sign on your bathroom window, you know, bathroom mirror, you know. I'm motivating this day to become enlightened for sentient beings. At the end of the day, I dedicate everything I did to the long lives of my gurus, to peace on earth, you know, enlightenment for all sentient beings, remembering us all empty. That's like the most basic Dharma practice. Then, endure both whatever arises. That means good or bad, you know, pleasure, pain, loss, gain, whatever's coming. You know, if I can develop an inner sense of well-being that's completely independent of what's going on outside of me, I can endure it. Almost, I mean, within reason, of course. You know, that's the point. Buddhism means an inner being. We're not dependent on outer conditions for our happiness. We figure out how to become happy inside. It doesn't mean we can't enjoy chocolate cake, you know. But it just means that in the big picture, my happiness comes from how I learn to cultivate my own happiness. And we're not born that way. We have to, well, maybe we are. We forget it, perhaps. But it's something that we have to train, we have to learn, we have to do, you know. Guard both as you would your life. That means, you know, your commitments, all your commitments to the, like if you've taken initiations and stuff, as you would your commitments, but also your commitment to practice mind training. You know, but that should be the most precious thing, is to realize that attaining enlightenment is the most precious thing. My wish and my practice in my life is the most precious thing. Let's see, where are we? Train in the three difficulties. Well, we've talked about that too. We did yesterday. That means recognize. You asked talking about ignoring. You know, don't ignore anything. Recognize it. The three difficulties is to recognize your delusions, recognize your pain, recognize your suffering, recognize your limitations, and don't get bummed out about it. Work with it. You know, work with it, and however you've learned to meditate by doing Tonglen or applying antidotes or meditating on emptiness, you know, recognize those ones and apply the antidote. Apply the antidote, whether it's meditating on karma, whether it's meditating on perfect human rebirth, whether it's meditating on the kindness of the guru. But the reason why we need to, you know, study Lam Rim a lot is because all those they're all different kinds of lojongs, you know, all different kinds of mind trainings. Of course, the most basic one is abandoning, cherishing myself more than others, and emptiness. But so that then when we do sit down and recognize delusions, we have a whole toolbox, you know. I can think about, you know, how am I going to work with this one? Am I going to think about renunciation here? Like, this is giving me a chance to think, wow, I just really don't want to be in samsara anymore, you know. Or maybe the best one to use here is, you know, this person cherishes themselves as much as anybody else, so why should I think that I'm more important than them? You know, there are all kinds of teachings that we have, and so it's important. This is why in the other one it said, the other day it said, to train in activity, in every activity by words, you know, so that we have words, you know, we're not just, when some bad thing happens to us, we're just like, oh, what am I going to do now? You know, you have your toolbox. You can open it up and figure out what you're going to do. And the easiest one is always just doing Tonglen, you know, just breathe in, breathe out. Or if you're really having a hard time, go see a friend. Talk to a friend, you know. It's okay. We can't expect to do it all on our own, you know. So let's see, where are we? So it says, so the three difficulties are recognize the delusions, apply the antidote until we can completely uproot, like stick with it until that delusion doesn't come anymore. Then practice the three main causes. So the three main causes, this is the three main causes for enlightenment or for Lojong, are that we have the wish. Remember we talked about the will. We have the will. We've been inspired. We have a wish to practice Dharma. And we have a spiritual teacher, and we rely on that spiritual teacher. It doesn't mean we have to ask the spiritual teacher everything that we need to do with our lives, but it also means that that spiritual teacher gives us guidelines by which we live our life, you know. Sometimes you can consult the teacher, but we don't always have to. But basically, we're relying on the teachings, you know. And then the third one is having the necessary conditions to practice Dharma. So this is something that I think we sometimes overlook. And one of the things that, like, Tara is really helpful for is for providing conditions. So say you're in a bad situation, you're in a bad relationship, you're in a bad job, you're in a bad... or maybe you just want to go to Nepal and do a retreat or something, but you need better conditions, conducive conditions, to help your Dharma practice. Well, instead of just accepting him, saying, well, I'm going to abandon the eight worldly Dharmas and just work with this condition, if you can change your conditions and give yourself a more conducive environment, do so. You know? Change your life if you can. You know? A lot of times in the beginning of Dharma practice, we have to change some of our friends. We can't, like, get drunk every night like we used to or something. You know, that's extreme. But so then it takes, in order to do that, you have to first have enough sense of self-worth, which is where we start. We start our Dharma practice with making sure that we value ourselves and that we have the confidence that we can practice. And then we can assess the situation. Is there any way I can make my life more conducive to Dharma? You know, if this is what I want, first it has to be what you want. If you don't care that much, it doesn't matter. But if it's really something that you want, it's like some past life big light bulb has gone off in your head and it's like, wow, I really want to do this with the rest of my life. Then we need to look around and with an honest assessment of what's reasonable, could I change something? Could I make something a little bit more helpful to me, you know? And then if it's not easily done, then I always pray to Tara to help me get it done. You know, I really have a lot of faith in Green Tara to, if you have the right motivation, you really pray, recite those 21 praises with the wish to get those conditions. I think that's Tara's job. She provides us. She's the mother of all the Buddhas, you know? So that's what they are. The wish, the will, follow the spiritual teachings and create the necessary conditions that you need, you know. Become acquainted with the three non-degenerations. Okay, they are faith, effort, and the ability to hold your understanding. Once you've gotten an understanding, don't forget it. Then possess the three inseparables. Act virtuously with your body, speech, and mind. Train without bias towards the objects. That means be impartial, you know, have equanimity. Don't like cats more than dogs or boys more than girls. It is important to train deeply and encompass all. That just means study the Lam Rim, you know. Really, don't leave anything out. Always meditate on special cases. That means people really that we can't get away from that bug us. You know, like certain family members or certain people at work. that we really need to work on those so that we don't end up causing harm or saying bad things. You know, we really have to work on figuring out how we can have a better relationship with this person, you know? Sometimes just remembering their kindness is all you need to do. Oh, apply the principle practice at this time. That means don't waste your perfect human rebirth. Remember over and over and over again that I have these conditions now. I may never have them again. Remember the story of the tortoise that's floating on the ocean with the golden yolk, and he comes up every 100 years. And the likelihood of that tortoise floating around the ocean, getting his neck in a golden yolk, is how infrequent it is we meet the Dharma in all of our zillions of lives. So if you really think about that, you know, we'll find the right conditions. Okay, then do not misinterpret. That means don't apply, like, don't have patience at the wrong time. Like, don't be patient with someone who's beating up a little boy, you know, stop him. You know, that's not time to be patient. Or, like, don't have wrong compassion. You know, sometimes, you know, you hear that story, grandmother compassion. We're being way too kind to people when we ought to be telling them that, you know, they should shape up or ship out. Or sometimes we have to have hard compassion for people, you know. But be really careful about that, you know. But grandmother compassion's not so helpful sometimes. Just allowing someone to continue with their codependency or yourself. You know, codependent behavior, you know. Alcoholic behavior, just, oh, they can't do any, I can't do any better than that. You know, and really you can. And then the last one is do not be erratic. In other words, practice thought training for a week and then forget about it for a year and, oh, I think I'll come back next year. And then, shucks, I thought that was the end. It's okay. Train with certainty means don't have any doubt. Just really go through the Lama room until you're totally certain. Be released by 2, investigation and analysis. That means identify the delusion in your mind and then really think about, you know, why am I doing this? You know, use your analytical mind to sort out what's going on. And maybe you do need some help outside, you know. The next one, do not be boastful. That's pretty simple. Do not get angry. Do not be unstable. That means, you know, going up and down all the time with your mind, you know. And do not wish for gratitude, because it turns kindness into a sham. If you're great, if you're kind to people and you expect them to give you something in return, which some people do, that's a mistake. Because then you've lost the whole point of why you're kind to somebody. You know, we're working here on unconditional love, not tit for tat. You know, if I give you this, you're going to give me that. You know. So then the conclusion is, because of my many wishes, having endured suffering and a bad reputation, I received the instructions for controlling self-grasping. Now, if I die, I have no regrets. So that's it. We did it. It's a bit of a marathon. Yeah. So thank you for the opportunity to go over this text. Thank you. It was Losang, Venerable Losang chose it. And we should just dedicate the merits that we're able to practice, that we can stay inspired, and remember the ideas that keep us inspired, you know. And being grateful, really being grateful to the Tibetans for the hardship they went through for us to have this incredible opportunity. You know, if we really think about the hardship they've experienced, you know, it's amazing.